Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Jeremy brings us a message where we consider Jesus' treatment of a fig tree. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Jeremy.
So good morning, South Harbor. Below average softball team. Like, welcome to South. We're just like you. But man, so this morning we get to continue a series we've been in for the last little bit. We've been looking at the book of Mark. And so if you're newer with us, we've been kind of exploring some questions that Mark is one of the authors of what we call our Gospels. We have four Gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Mark's goal in writing what he wrote is Mark wants you to know something about who Jesus is. That Mark's kind of writing a biography of Jesus. And so we're asking the questions, like, what are the things when Mark says, like, oh, if you're going to know Jesus, like, you need to know these things. And so we've been kind of walking through Mark, asking those questions. And this morning's story might feel a little obscure. This morning's story, some of it might be a little bit familiar, especially if you've spent time around church. Like, you might be familiar with some of it. And then part of the story also just feels like this weird, like, hold on, what is going on? And what is Jesus doing? And for some of us, when we read a little bit more of kind of a strange, obscure story like this, it also causes us to ask the big questions, like, but what does this story have to do with the things that really actually matter, right? Like, does Jesus care about the injustices or justice in the world? What does God think about all of the ways that, like, his name might be attached to something that really doesn't look at all like him, whether it's a movement or a political agenda, or what does God think about those things? And we look at a story like this one this morning, and some of it can be, why this one? But my hope is, as we kind of explore this story together, those answers kind of become a little bit more obvious. Maybe in this obscure story, Jesus is actually answering all of those big, deeper questions. And so what we're going to do, we're going to read it kind of in its entirety. So we're going to be in Mark chapter 11. Mark chapter 11, we will kind of read it all. And then we'll kind of step back. We'll ask some questions of it, and we'll see where the story takes us. So Mark chapter 11, we start at verse 12. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Now, to set the scene, we're kind of during Passover week. And so Jesus is in Jerusalem. Bethany is kind of just over the Mount of Olives from Jerusalem. So they're in Jerusalem for Passover. They're heading into Jerusalem. Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard him say it. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables and the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers'?" The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. In the morning, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. Peter remembered and said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered." It's a weird story, isn't it? So the way we're going to kind of dive into the story is Tim actually started us on a game. It's a game that we play often here at South Harbor. We dusted it back off last week, so I figure, why not go 2 weeks in a row? And so the game, if you weren't here with us last week, is called Find the Elephant. And essentially what we do with Find the Elephant, if you're newer with us, too often when we approach a story, when we read something out of the scriptures, we just kind of like, we read it and we just kind of nod along. Like, okay, the next thing comes. But in Find the Elephant, what we do is we give ourselves the permission to step back and to ask the big questions. When God kind of named his people, God renames a guy by the name of Jacob into Israel. Israel means one who wrestles with God. I'm pretty sure that God's okay with us continuing to wrestle and ask the big questions. And so kind of a guide, when we're finding the elephant, like, what are the things that feel weird? What are the details that feel just like, why does he include that detail? It feels unnecessary. It feels obscure. It feels unnecessary. What are the things that don't make sense in the text? And so would we name that this text has a handful of elephants? Right? What elephants would you find? Maybe the biggest elephant, right? Like, why does Jesus kill a tree? Right? Can we name that's an elephant? Like, of all of the things, anybody ever wear like a WWJD, like what would Jesus do bracelet? Like, you put that on, in the back of your head, you're not thinking walking around cursing trees is an option. And yet Jesus kills a tree. Why does Jesus kill the tree? And then did you notice, like, Mark not only tells us that Jesus like kills this tree because it did not have fruit, but Mark includes like an interesting little detail in that. Where Mark says he curses the tree, and he says, because it was not yet season for figs. Did you notice that? He says it right in the text. It says he found nothing but leaves because it was not yet season. So hold on. So Jesus killed a fig tree for not having figs when it wasn't even the right season to have figs? Now, I've been hangry before in my life. Right? Like, some of us immediately feel justified for the things that we've done when we were hungry. Jesus apparently killed a tree. So is that, what is Jesus doing? Is it that Jesus is punishing a tree for something that the tree isn't, it's not really the tree's fault, right? Like, is that who Jesus is? Is that what Jesus does? And for some of us, that question alone might actually kind of hit something deep inside of us, right? Because for some of us, you've tried to wrestle with, like, why have things in your life happened the way they have? And there are times when you feel like maybe you're being punished for something that's not your fault. Anybody ever grow up with, like, a younger sibling, right? But then when you're asking the question, like, okay, but what is Jesus the same way? If he punishes a tree for something that's not his fault, what else might he be up to? It's an elephant. Then another elephant, right? Right in the middle of this weird story about a tree, we have Jesus like throwing what I'm going to call this morning a temple tantrum, right? Like, he walks in and he's flipping tables. What is Jesus doing in the temple? And then do you notice it's during Passover. If you were here with us through the Exodus, kind of we did some, 40 weeks looking at the book of Exodus. If you know Passover, Passover is all around this time when the Israelite people, they were slaves in Egypt. God set them free. And in kind of that process of setting them free, he had them offer a sacrifice of an animal. Do you remember the animal? It's a lamb, right? And so you kill a lamb. People would go to Jerusalem every year for Passover, and you would sacrifice a lamb. Did you notice the things that were on the table that Jesus is flipping over? It's not lambs, but apparently there's people in the temple selling doves. Why are they? Passover is about a lamb. Why are people selling doves? It was right in the text. So why? Why is that happening? And then do you notice, like, right in the middle of the temple tantrum, there's this thing there's this detail that Mark includes that says that as Jesus is flipping over the tables, Jesus then, he says something, but the way Mark explains it feels interesting to me. Like, as Jesus is flipping tables, Mark says that he was in that process, he was teaching them something. He's flipping tables. It says, as he was teaching them. So like, what is Jesus actually teaching them in the flipping of tables and the thing that he's going to say next? What is Jesus doing there? And then are we good on the elephant so far? There's another elephant I find, and it's really, if we even kind of step back from the individual details of the story, and it's in how Mark even tells the story. It's a strange telling, isn't it? Because we start with Jesus cursing a fig tree. Then Jesus goes into the temple. Jesus does what he does in the temple. And then it's not until Jesus leaves the temple the next morning, Mark needs us to know that Jesus didn't just curse the fig tree, but afterwards the fig tree actually died. It's an extra sentence, Mark, but why does Mark tell it this way? It's like fig tree, temple, fig tree. And then for some of us, maybe the biggest elephant, maybe the biggest question is, why should I care? Right? Like, why? What does this have to do with anything? Jesus killing trees, like maybe you're like the botanist type and like you really care about trees. And like for you, like it's really problematic that Jesus killed the tree. But really at the heart of it, like why should I care? And then there's the interesting detail in the story that it's this moment is going to be one of the pivotal moments that's going to cause like the leaders, like the political leaders and the religious leaders to essentially come together and go, oh, in this, Jesus went too far. Like this becomes one of those moments that makes the people in charge say, for this, we need to get rid of him. This will be one of the moments that leads to Jesus actually being executed by the leadership. Why? What is it in this story? Well, to kind of start to unpack the story, I figure let's start where Mark starts. And so let's start with the fig tree. This is a picture of a fig tree. This isn't in Jerusalem. This is Megiddo. It's like 75 miles north of Jerusalem. But fig trees are it's a tree you're going to find throughout Israel. Jesus is, it says, walking along. He says a fig tree in leaf, but it's not producing fruit. This is actually fairly common for the life of a fig tree. So Jesus is there during Passover. Passover is really closely connected to like Easter, right? So like what month is Passover? Usually April. It's April. And so the fig tree is going to be covered in leaves. It is going to produce its fruit in kind of late summer. It's kind of August, September is when it's going to produce its fruit. And the interesting thing about a fig tree, if we go to that next slide, so a fig is only, once a fig ripens, has anybody here ever actually eaten like a ripe fig? A couple of us? It's incredibly unlikely because they only ripen for a short period in a year. And once you pick a fig tree off from the branch, the thing is going to go bad in somewhere less than 3 days. So it's basically, unless you have a fig tree, you've likely never eaten a fresh fig. You can refrigerate it. You can extend it to like, it'll last maybe 4 or 5 days, but that's about it. A fig, if we actually... One thing that I just found fascinating that really doesn't have to do with anything, hey, the fig fruit is actually an inverted flower. So it's like a flower that turns inside. The things that you eat on the inside is actually the flower part of the flower. That's fascinating. Jesus shows up and he finds this fig tree. He sees it. It's got leaves on it. It doesn't have fruit because the fruit's going to come in August or September. He sees it. He curses it. It will later die. Why does Jesus do this with the fig tree? And in order to understand that, we first need to kind of step back and ask a bigger question around like, okay, what is Mark doing in his structure and how Mark tells the story? Because Mark is being really intentional in the way he tells this story. Mark will actually do this about 9 times in his gospel, in the Gospel of Mark. It's what scholars will call the Markan sandwich. It sounds delicious, doesn't it? I put it on top of the McDonald's new big arch, right? Anybody see this from this last year? It's like McDonald's has a new 1,000-calorie hamburger. And my social media feed was filled with it. And I still find it fascinating that the questions people are asking isn't, does America need another 1,000-calorie cheeseburger right now? But the question is apparently, like, how big of a bite actually counts as a bite of said 1,000-calorie cheeseburger? But Mark and Sandwich, what Mark does, 9 times in the Gospel of Mark, Mark will tell a story like he does this one, where essentially what he does is he takes a story and he splits it in two, and then he puts something in the middle. Okay, does this make sense? And so the story that comes before and after, think of it like the bun of the sandwich, right? Nobody eats a sandwich for the bun, unless you're like a psychopath. Like, you eat the sandwich for what comes in the middle, right? The bun kind of holds it. So Mark, if you're reading through the book of Mark, and Mark, like, it feels like he starts telling a story, and then, like, he pivots from it, and then he comes back to it, like, a light bulb should go off in your brain, like, oh, Mark is doing something. And so what Mark is doing is he's using that kind of first and last story to say something about what's happening in the middle. The bun kind of gives commentary on the story in the middle. Does this kind of make sense? So if we want to try to figure out, okay, how do these stories relate to one another? Like, what is Mark saying in creating said Mark 11, Mark and Sandwich? Let's look at that layer in the middle. It's kind of that thing that Jesus does in the temple. So I want to put it back up. And then what we're going to do is I want to kind of try to bring you into the story. Like, I almost want to, like, pretend like you are, like, the 13th disciple that day following Jesus around. And we're going to kind of see what you would have seen and kind of hear what you would have heard. But let's read it, and then let's kind of enter into it. And so on reaching Jerusalem, Jesus said, enter the temple courts, began driving out those who were buying and selling. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. As he taught them, he said, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. So this part, I want to try to, like, enter the story. So you, that day, you are disciple number 13. And so as we approach Jerusalem, what you're going to see is this. It says we're coming from Bethany, so you're cresting the Mount of Olives. This is actually, it's a model of what the first century temple would have looked like. This is actually at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. But it's oriented as if you are standing kind of on or probably above the Mount of Olives. So from the Mount of Olives, you're looking out at the Temple Mount. Temple right here faces east, so we are east, we are on the Mount of Olives. What you would do if you're Jesus' 13th disciple, you're with him approaching the temple that day, what you're going to do is you're going to approach from kind of the southwest corner right over here. So if you've ever seen pictures of, like, the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, where people to this day, like, we brought groups there, you put kind of prayers in the wall, that's going to be on the backside of the wall kind of right here. And so Jesus and his disciples, when they approach the temple, they're going to come again from just the other side of this wall. Let me show you a picture of what it would look like today. It's called, like, First Century Street, or we've named it the Herodian Street because Herod did this giant temple kind of reconstruction on the temple. You'll notice the street is kind of all beaten in. There's a bunch of boulders. In 70 AD, Rome is going to come in and destroy the temple. They're going to destroy it. They are going to, when Jesus says they will leave no stone unturned, they're actually going to take stones from the top of the Temple Mount and throw them over the side. The impact of those stones hitting the ground is going to cause these divots. Some of the rocks that Rome literally destroyed the temple with are still there. But one of the things, if you're disciple 13, you're walking down this street. Right now, it's usually pretty empty, maybe a couple tour groups. During the time Jesus shows up, especially during Passover, this street is filled with activity. During Passover, you'll have a couple 100,000 people will enter Jerusalem to celebrate Passover here. And one of the central parts of the activity on the street is going to happen in this structure right here. There would have been more of it. Some of it got destroyed. But if we get a little bit closer, this is kind of a close-up of that structure on the side. What this is would have been a number of shops right next to each other. If you've ever gone to Tanger, right? Like Nike's down at the end. But this is a series of shops. And anytime you go to the temple, but especially during Passover, these shops are filled with activity. There are people, there's noises, there's things happening. And so the question then is, why and what shops were in these little crevices? Well, there's a couple of things that were going on in the temple that kind of led to the kind of creation of these shops. One, if you came to the temple, you would be bringing you'd be bringing currency to the temple in order to potentially buy something that you would need for the temple. The religious leaders recognized there was a problem with their world's currency. See, let me see if you can find the problem. In the first century AD, during the time of Jesus, the most dominant coin in circulation is this. It's called the tribute penny. The tribute penny on the left side, it has a picture of Tiberius. There's an inscription, kind of this inscription, reads, "Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus." Do you see a problem that the Jewish people might have had if you're going to show up with currency to use in the temple to worship your God when your coin claims that the emperor is the son of God? Do we see a problem here? The Jewish people recognized, this is a problem. And the religious leaders, the Jewish people, also in the back of their minds, they had a command that God had given them all the way back in the Ten Commandments. God in the Ten Commandments said, "You shall not make a carved image of anyone under heaven or earth." And so you also recognize you would be bringing a carved image, not just a carved image, but a carved image bearing an inscription calling them the Son of God to enter into the temple and to use the coins. The Jewish people decided, This is not acceptable. You cannot use this in the temple. How could we ever think we're going to bring coinage declaring somebody else to be God in order to worship our God? And so what the religious leaders did is they set up a whole system where you would come bringing your currency, but then you would have to trade it in for what we call temple currency. Okay, does this make sense? Like, anybody ever travel overseas? Like, back before, you could just use your credit card anywhere, right? Like, if you're going to go to a foreign country, you need to change your money into theirs. Same thing happened in the temple. So the coin that was approved for use in the temple is this guy. It's a Tyrian shekel. You can already tell the religious leaders are kind of compromising on some of their values with the shekel. What's a problem you see with the shekel? There's no inscription of somebody being a god, but what do you still have? A carved image of somebody. It's not the emperor. It doesn't declare him god, but this is actually, it's fascinating, this is actually Phoenician god Merkhet. He's often identified with Hercules. But the religious leaders, they came up with a bunch of reasons why this coin was acceptable. And what they said is it's because of the high silver content of the Tyrian shekel. The Tyrian shekel contains 94% to 96% silver. Well, that tribute penny, that contains way less. So like that's not suitable to bring to God. This is. But behind the whole thing, it feels like there was something also a bit more devious. Because what the religious leaders recognized is if they could monopolize the only currency that you could actually use at the temple, what do you see happening? They started realizing that if the only money you can use in the temple you have to get from us, we now control the exchange rate. Right? It's not just a one for one, you give us yours, we give you temple tax, we give you the Tyrian shekel. Now they started adding interest to it. And so now the religious leaders are getting rich on the trading of currency that they're telling you, you have to have this coin to use in the temple. They now control the exchange rate. The religious leaders are getting rich on the system that was designed to bring people in so that they could worship God. And then the religious leaders realized, there's still money left on the table. There's more ways that we can get rich off from this system that we are now in control of. And so if we go back to the shops, so you're that 13th disciple. And some of these are money changers. Hundreds of thousands of people at Passover all having to change out their currency. But then there's also the thing about what you use your currency for. Because when you would go to Jerusalem, especially during Passover, you and your family, you would show up to offer a sacrifice. And so what you could do as a responsible, fiscally responsible first century Jewish person, you could decide, you know what, I'm gonna take one of my own sheep. Like, I'm gonna take a lamb from my flock, and when we go to Jerusalem, we're just gonna carry it along, we're gonna bring it, and we'll offer that as the sacrifice. Well, what the religious leaders knew is that God in the Torah, and the Torah is kind of the first five books of the Bible. It's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. In the Torah, God gives this command that the animal you sacrifice is to be blameless, is to be without fault. And what the religious leaders knew is that in order for you or your family to offer a sacrifice at the temple, they were the ones who were going to look over your animal to make sure that it was blameless, that it didn't have a blemish, that there wasn't a scar from when it ran into something or a birthmark. Now, question, if you've ever worked on a farm or if you have a pet, how likely is it that an animal is completely without blemish ever? Low, right? And so if you're the religious leaders, it's your job to make sure that the sacrifice a person or a family is making has no markings, has no scars, has no blemishes. The religious leaders recognized, oh, if we look hard enough, we could find something in almost any animal to say, oh, We're so sorry. Like, we see you did a lot of work bringing that animal here, but unfortunately, there's this thing over here and it disqualifies it. But then the religious leaders are able to say, but you're in luck. Because what we have is we have our own set of animals that you can buy from us. And not only can you buy the animals from us, but they come pre-approved, right? We've already inspected them. We can tell you, like, you don't have to worry that we're going to go over this one with a fine-tooth comb because we already have and we found it blameless. You buy it from us. What do you see happening? We now control how much we would charge for the animal that you or your family are going to sacrifice, right? And so all of a sudden now, you have the religious leaders who are in charge of the exchange rate of the currency that you need to get in order to buy something at the temple. And then they are in control of the selling of animals that you are going to sacrifice. Everything comes at another upcharge. Do you see how this happens? And now, so the religious leaders, they were the people who are supposed to be in charge of the temple, where people are supposed to gather together in order to worship and in Passover, remember a time when God set the people free. And the religious leaders look at it, and what they see is a whole lot of customers. And so they are getting unbelievably wealthy on the backs of everyone who's showing up to worship at the temple. And so what happens, especially during Passover, is business is booming. Hundreds of thousands of people, everybody needs to change over the currency. If you don't have an animal that gets approved, you need to buy it from them. What happens is the religious leaders look at kind of that street that they've got those shops on, and they recognize, oh, this isn't enough space, right? Business is good. Business is booming. There are all these opportunities. We need to expand, right? Because that's what you do when things are going well. You expand. That's what the religious leaders did. And so if you're disciple number 13 that day, you show up at the streets, there's all the shops, they're exchanging currency. If you're going to move from the street into the temple, you're going to come up, this is kind of an artistic like reconstruction of this whole staircase was all destroyed when Rome destroys the temple in 70 AD. They destroy the whole thing. But notice there's kind of this ledge, and then there's a little kind of platform before we would enter. If we were there today and we take a photo, Notice the ledge and the elevated. This is the whole arch. It's called Robinson's Arch. It was destroyed in 70 AD. But our shops are right down here. On that day, your disciple 13, you're going to walk up the stairs into what would have been an arch right here on the temple wall, and you're going to enter the temple courts. Let me show you the temple court. The temple court is this guy. It looks small on a model. First century, it would have been about 35 acres big. So this thing is huge. And then within the temple, there were a handful of kind of dedicated spaces. So depending on what ethnicity you were, what gender you were, there was different levels of kind of, let's say, access that you would have to the temple. So if we zoom in on this structure, here, we're zoomed in. You've got in the inner court, you've got what we call the court of the priests. This is the place that only the priests are able to go. This is where they're going to offer sacrifices on behalf of the people. So court of the priests is right here, kind of just around the court of the priests, still kind of in that structure, is going to be what's called the court of Israel. It's a little deceiving because it's not every Israelite can enter the court of Israel. The only people that were allowed in the court of Israel are the Israelite men. So you have the court of priests. Then just outside of the court of priests, you have the court of Israel, the court of Israelite men. Then in this section, you have what's called the court of women, which is also a little bit deceptive because it's not all women, it's Jewish Israelite women. So you have court of priests, court of men, court of women, and then you have this giant outside. So if you zoom back out, notice the largest area on the temple court is this huge guy. So if priests are here, men are here, women are here, the rest of it is the court of the Gentiles. The bulk of the temple was space that was dedicated so that anyone and everyone from anywhere, whatever people group you come from, whatever nationality you are, whatever language you speak, the bulk of the temple was designed so that you have a space to come, that you have a place that you can enter, you can gather, and you can worship God amongst us. So what happens this day? Jesus shows up in Jerusalem. That street right on the other side of the wall, they're changing currency, they're selling animals, business is good, business is expanding. They decide the street isn't enough space. They need to expand, they need more territory. Did you notice in the story where it says Jesus is flipping over the tables of the money changers and those selling doves? In the temple courts. So where did they choose to expand? They chose to expand. That Robinson's Arch is going to, this is called the Royal Stoa. You would have walked up those stairs. You would have entered kind of right on the backside of this corner. What Jesus does is he enters into the Gentile courts. The spaces that were designed were for the entire world to gather to worship. I remember all the way back, Genesis chapter 12, God kind of gives his people a mission statement. He says, I'm going to bless you. But the reason I'm going to bless you is so that you can be a blessing to all people everywhere. The temple was kind of an architectural kind of like designed around that blessing, right? Like each circle was kind of designed to serve those around it. The bulk of it was where the world was supposed to gather in order to worship. And Jesus shows up. And what he finds isn't a space that was dedicated, that was saved for the world to gather to worship. But what Jesus finds is this has become largely a giant economic center where the religious leaders are getting rich in the spaces where the Gentiles, where the world was supposed to gather to worship. And Jesus wants none of it. He wants none of it. Which is why I think Jesus does what he does next. So he starts flipping tables, less like temple tantrum, and more Jesus is saying, you are misusing the space. Jesus is clearing out the space so that, not just because he's mad at it, but so that he can create space so that the world may enter and the world may worship along with them. I think it makes sense of why Jesus says what he says. Mark, remember, Mark says that as Jesus is doing this, he's teaching them. And so the question, like, what is he teaching them and how is this teaching them? Well, it says that as he taught them, he said, is it not written? And then always pay attention to quotes, right? Because when there's quotes, that means Jesus is quoting something. And so, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, end quote, but you have made it, new quote, a den of robbers. Your disciple 13, you've heard these words before. You know these words. And you know what Jesus is doing in these words because there is a kind of rhetorical practice that a good Jewish rabbi would employ. And it's called remez. Remez means hint. And so Jesus is speaking these words to a world that knew their old, they knew their scriptures, what we call our Old Testament. And so if Jesus is going to quote something, they know what comes next. It's the example that I always use around remez is, let's pretend, it's my wife's birthday today. So let's pretend I were to tell her, I'd say like, hey, roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet. You know what I'm saying, right? And so are you. I'm actually saying something about my wife, even though I'm not actually saying that part, but she knows I am because she knows what comes next. Does that make sense? In Jesus' world, Jesus would drop a quote, and to his world, they knew what comes next. So Jesus wasn't just saying what he says. He was also implying the rest of it that comes later. So Jesus here, your disciple 13, you're taking two passages you know of from the Old Testament. You now recognize Jesus is putting these two things together. Let me show them to you. One's out of Isaiah, the other Jeremiah. So Isaiah 56 starts this way. Let no foreigner who is bound to the Lord say, the Lord will surely exclude me from my people. What's another name for a foreigner in their world? A Gentile. Let no Gentile who wants to worship say, I am excluded from the people. For, verse 7, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. We fast forward just a few verses later, same chapter, his audience would have known this. It says, Israel's watchmen, who were kind of the people that were Israel's watchmen? The priests, the religious leaders, the ones who are in charge of the temple, they are blind. They lack all knowledge. They're dogs with mighty appetites. They never have enough. They're shepherds who lack understanding. They all turned their own way. They seek their own gain. So when Jesus is quoting this in the temple, as he's overthrowing the economic system they'd created in the very Gentile courts, Jesus is making a direct call against the religious leaders who are using the space of worship in order to get filthy rich off the backs of the people. My house is supposed to be a house of prayer, but you made it a den of robbers. Jesus takes a piece out of Jeremiah. It says, if you do not oppress the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, this is a prophet kind of speaking to the religious leaders, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal and follow other gods you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which bears my name, and say, we are safe to do all these detestable things. Has this house, which bears my name, become a den of robbers to you? Jesus is offering a stark critique on the religious establishment, the religious leaders of his day, and it's seeping into the temple itself. We know the whole piece of like the religious leaders having an incredible appetite that does not get filled. Archaeologists have actually unearthed some of the high priest's homes around Jerusalem. The high priests were like the ones in charge of the temple system. We found wine cellars in the homes of the high priest with bottles of wine that it's always hard to kind of evaluate a 2,000-year-old bottle of wine, but they estimate the bottles of wine that they found in the cellar to be roughly somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 a bottle, and the cellar would hold hundreds of them. The establishment is getting rich on the backs of the people, which then makes even a little bit more sense on why Jesus does one of the things that he does, one of those elephants. So he's flipping over the tables of the money changers, but he's also flipping over the tables of those selling doves. Why the doves? Right? Passover, you're supposed to come and bring a lamb. Jesus flipping tables of those selling doves. Well, there's kind of a permission in the book of Leviticus. Let me read it to you. Next one, Leviticus 5. So it says, as a penalty for the sin they have committed, they, the people, must bring to the Lord a female lamb or goat from the flock as a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for them for their sin. Okay. Anyone who cannot afford a lamb is to bring two doves or two young pigeons to the Lord as a penalty for their sin, one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. Why does Jesus maybe go especially after the tables of the doves? Why does Mark at least tell us that Jesus explicitly goes after the table for the doves? Well, the religious leaders are even oppressing the most needy, the poorest among us. If you can't afford a lamb, just buy a couple doves and God will accept those. You'll be fine with those. And the religious leaders are even selling doves, making their excessive wealth on even the backs of the poorest of those among them. And Jesus comes in and says, I've had it with all of it. And Mark puts that story right in the middle of killing a fig tree. Why? What is Mark doing with the sandwich? Well, if we go back to the fig tree, there's something, if you grew figs, you know about the fig tree that's kind of untrue of something I said earlier, that the fig tree was not in season. Yes, the figs will come into season in August or September. But the interesting thing with a fig tree is it produces some early fruit. It's called brebel. It's this. So you notice, like, you've got the leaves that are starting. Brebel will often either form either in kind of with the leaves or even just a little bit before the leaves. It's actually not considered part of this year's fruit. It's a little bit tied to kind of last year's version of the tree. But when a fig tree starts to produce leaves right around the month of April, that fruit should be present. So what month is Jesus walking into Jerusalem? April. He sees a fig tree in leaf, which means it should, the season of figs will come in a few months, but it should at least have some of that early fruit, that brebel, that edible kind of, they call it like an edible, like pre-fruit. It should have been there. It's not. And so Jesus pronounces a curse on the tree that has leaves, but has not started producing that early fruit. And I think what Jesus is doing is Jesus essentially looking at that tree and saying, that tree with all of its leaves, it looks like it's full of life. It looks alive, but it's actually not producing fruit. The tree looks alive, but it's not fruitful. And so Jesus pronounces a curse, speaks at the tree for looking alive but not being fruitful as a way of giving commentary on the temple system. That the temple system, it looked alive. There were hundreds of thousands of people flooding the temple. There was all this bustle of activity. There's sacrifices being made. There's animals being bought. There's all of this stuff happening at the temple. It looks alive. But Jesus is saying, it's one of those, when you read the miracles of Jesus, they can read kind of like they're these just like one-off things that Jesus is doing as he's going along. But almost always, Jesus is doing it to teach them a lesson. And in this one, Jesus kills the fig tree as a way of telling them the entire system, it looks alive, but it's broken. It's not producing fruit. So for us, what does the story do for us today? Well, I've been wrestling with the story for the last few weeks, and it's caused me to kind of ask a couple questions. One, maybe a question is, what might Jesus need to overturn in us? And I don't mean just us, I mean like the church, right? Because unfortunately, the thing that was true of the temple system of Jesus' day is that they became so insider-focused, so focused on like us and ours, that they lost sight of the people that it was always supposed to be about? What would it look like for the church to lean into that, if there's barriers of people finding their way back to God, to be a place that continues to remove those things so that anyone and everyone becomes welcome into the space and can come to know Jesus? What might God need to overthrow in us? But because we're lacking in time a little bit, the second question, what might Jesus need to overthrow in me, to overturn in me? What are maybe some places in my life where maybe I've missed the plot, where I've missed the point, or where maybe I'm going through the motions, but I've lost the heart of why? What might Jesus need to overturn in me, in you? Maybe it's something that it's a good thing, but it's kind of become just about motions. You started the Bible reading plan, and you started it because you want to put the words of Scripture in you, and you want to be transformed by the ways of Jesus. And over time, it's kind of just turned into a bunch of boxes that you just have to check. And now the goal is less about getting those words in you and being changed by them. And the goal is just to check off this box. What in you maybe it's become something that's just going through the motions. It looks like leaves, but it's not yet producing, but it's no longer producing fruit. Maybe it's even not something that's a bad thing. This kind of hit me yesterday. Because one of the things that I feel like God calling me to is I'm realizing my kids are getting older. I've got a junior, a freshman, and a seventh grader, and realizing life is busy, right? It's like pickups and drop-offs and school sports and sports and sports and practices. And I realize so often I can kind of live my life in this just going through the motions of I'm not always present where I am. Does this make sense? Like, it's always, okay, who's the next kid that I got to pick up and where do they have to drop them off? And then what's coming later? And then what's coming? And then at the end of the night, sometimes there's so little left of me, it's just doom scrolling the phone. And me realizing that, okay, maybe what God's calling me to be is more just present in the spaces I'm in with the people around me. And there was a moment yesterday when you work on a sermon for weeks up to the point that you stand on a stage and give it. And this past week is the one that you kind of put words on paper and you try to get it. And ideally, you get it done kind of late week, and it'll still kind of be with you into the weekend. But this one, there's a chunk in the middle that it was a lot of content, it's a lot of info. I was trying to still figure out, like, okay, how do you move through it in a way that, like, helps make sense of the passage, but also isn't just brain dumping information on you so that, like, hopefully you stay engaged and follow along. And even I was even working on it yesterday morning into late morning and still trying to move some pieces around and still not feeling great about it. And then I had to make a decision because my youngest daughter had a basketball tournament in Lansing. And I had to make a decision. Either I stay home and try to work on the flow of the middle of the sermon, or I shut the laptop and I join my family and I go watch my daughter's basketball game. And I felt this conviction, and neither of those are bad options, but I felt this conviction that God was calling me to be present with my family in these moments that I have with them. And so it hit me. I was like, shoot, in 6 weeks, none of us would be able to remember a part of the middle of the sermon that might have felt clunky. But I can tell you in 6 weeks, my daughter will remember whether or not I was on the sideline of her basketball game. And so for me, I shut the laptop and I got in the car and I went off to East Lansing. But for you, at Go Blue, what are the things that maybe Jesus is wanting to overturn in you, where it's no longer going through the motions, but we get back to the heart of the why? And this morning, we actually get an opportunity to kind of practice some of that. Because this morning, we get to gather around the tables for communion. And it's at communion, and we could just go through motions. We come up, we grab bread, we could dip it in juice, we could eat it. Or we could actually kind of remember the why. Why do any of it? Right? And at communion, we remember that God so loved the world, God so loved you, that he would stop at nothing, to create a space where you can come back to him, that Jesus would lay down his own life for you. And so the way we do communion here at South is in just a few moments.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.